I'm Gregory Berg. The year 2017 marks the 75th anniversary of the emergence of a new kind of children's book, the famous Golden Books, created by Western Publishing in Racine. Back in 2008, I had the great pleasure of doing a phone interview with an expert on children's literature, Leonard Marcus, who came to Carthage at the invitation of John Stuig, then director of the Center for Children's Literature. Leonard Marcus had just written a fascinating book called Golden Legacy, How Golden Books Won Children's Hearts, Changed Publishing Forever, and Became an American Icon Along the Way. That beautiful book has just been re-released to commemorate the 75th anniversary of Golden Books and retitled Golden Legacy, The Story of Golden Books. And this felt like a great opportunity to revisit that interview and share it with you. Leonard Marcus has written a number of fascinating books about children's literature. Among them, Show Me a Story, Why Picture Books Matter, Conversations with 21 of the World's Most Celebrated Illustrators. Comics Confidential, 13 Graphic Novelists Talk Story Craft and Life Outside the Box. And Minders of Make-Believe, Idealists, Entrepreneurs, and the Shaping of American Children's Literature. Again, the book at hand is retitled Golden Legacy, The Story of Golden Books, re-released this year to celebrate the 75th anniversary of the publication of the very first Golden Books. Tell us a little bit about your interesting career as a writer and to what extent writing for children is sort of a central part of your interests.
Well, I became interested in children's books as a history major in college in the 1970s. And I was studying early American history and thought that if children's books had been written at that time, it would be an unusual way of getting at how the generation that had grown up during the American Revolution thought about what they'd done and what they wanted to pass on to their children about it, because that's what children's books are about. They're express the dreams and hopes of one generation for the next generation. So I went to the library and I found that there were lots of children's books in the early 19th century, and that each one really could be looked at not just as the story that it was there to tell, but also as part of a bigger story about American culture, how it changes from one generation to the next.
Well, and it probably, in the many conversations I've had with John Stuig from the Center for Children's Literature, one theme that to which we've returned again and again is how for so many people, the wonderful books they read as children stay with them all their lives, and probably in ways that we do not begin to even fully appreciate, can actually be profoundly affected by those books that were important to them as youngsters. I mean, it's not just important to people when they are the children reading those books for the first time.
Oh, I think that's true. And what you say brings to mind a story told to me by one of the many people I interviewed when I was researching the history of Golden Books. In the early 1960s, they published a large format book about dinosaurs. And at that time, there really weren't many books for children or for adults either, for that matter, on that subject. And that child grew up to be Dr. Robert Bakker, who's one of the world's authorities on dinosaurs now. And, you know, he points to that book as the thing that excited him, you know, got him on his way to becoming a world authority on something. I think that happens to lots of children. And in a more general way, children's books, when they're really good, touch our deepest feelings in the clearest and strongest possible way. And they give us feelings about, what's possible in life and what's beautiful about life and what to, watch out for. They really deal in the most basic things.
I notice in the list of other books which you have written that we see some familiar names from this story of Golden Books. I mean, one of your books listed in the credits is Margaret Wise Brown, Awakened by the Moon. Another, Dear Genius, The Letters of Ursula Nordstrom. Here are two people who figure prominently in the pages of this book, specifically about Golden Publishing. So, of course, you have already had some very direct acquaintance with some of the people who figure prominently in the history of this particular series of books.
That's true. I wrote my biography of Margaret Wise Brown, who is best known as the author of Goodnight Moon, but actually wrote over 100 picture books during her brief but amazingly fruitful career. I began doing that in the early 80s when many of her friends were still alive in their 70s and 80s. And so I got to meet many of the people who worked on Golden Books, the editors, some of the illustrators that she worked with. Goodnight Moon itself was not a Golden Book, but Margaret Wise Brown loved the idea of Golden Books, which was partly to make less expensive books that could reach the most children. She was really about not just sitting in an ivory tower and writing beautiful little stories, but actually, you know, shaping children's lives. So when Golden Books came along with a new way of marketing and distributing books on a mass market scale, she thought it was a great thing. Many of the critics of her day didn't, because they thought it was sort of going too commercial, but you didn't have to look at it that way, and that really wasn't what it was about.
Hmm. And maybe we'll get to her again through the course of our interview, but mention briefly the significance of Ursula Nordstrom, someone else you have written about ahead of writing this book we're talking about today.
Sure. Well, she was the person in charge of children's book publishing at Harper and Brothers, the company now known as HarperCollins. So she herself was not directly involved in creating Golden Books, but she worked with many of the same authors and illustrators who did. Margaret Wise Brown was one. She published Goodnight Moon. She also published many books by the wonderful illustrator Garth Williams. People will know him as the illustrator of Charlotte's Web and the Little House books, all of which were published by Harper. But he also jumped in, just as Margaret Wise Brown did, early on when Golden Books came along in the 1940s, because it was a great chance to reach millions of kids instead of thousands of kids.
Hmm. We're speaking with Leonard Marcus, and we're talking now specifically about a book called Golden Legacy. It's a book about the famous Golden Books that were published in Racine, Wisconsin, by Western Publishing. Maybe ahead of talking about how this company came into being, you could give us an idea of the world which was waiting to be reshaped. That is, what was the general idea about what children's books should be, what they should look like? That is, before
Sure. Mm-hmm.
this new kind of children's book was created.
Sure. Well, in the 19th century, there was a lot of interest in providing books for children in America, but it was done in a sort of helter-skelter fashion. No editor at a publishing house in America was a children's book editor. It was something that you did as one of the many assignments that you had in your work life. Then a big change happened at the beginning of the 20th century when Andrew Carnegie gave millions of dollars for towns and cities all across America to build public libraries, and a room was set aside in all of those libraries for children. That was a time of social reform, and people were thinking about child labor laws and you know, how many years children should be required to go to public school. There was a lot of interest in making the lives of children better on a national scale, and the decision to offer free library service to children was a part of that. Well, the librarians became the tastemakers of children's literature, and they also created a big market for children's books. And once that happened, publishers began to have specialists of their own who would be able to talk to these librarians and figure out what books they should be publishing so they could sell them to all the libraries across America. So in the years leading up to when Golden Books came along in the early 1940s, the libraries were the major market for children's books in America. And there was a lot of interest in books that worked well at story time, once upon a time tales, fairy tales. And librarians had a sort of a missionary view of what they were doing. They thought that children's books should be aesthetically beautiful objects. They should be almost like the first experience of art and they should be the first experience of art and literature for kids. It would be almost like going to a museum to open up a picture book. That was great. And some very beautiful books were produced as a result. And they tended to be kind of expensive. And probably only about 10% of the American public could afford to buy them for their own children.
You mentioned at one point in the book that in the 1930s, the average price of a hardbound children's picture book was between $1.50 and $2.
That's right.
And when we think about a dollar in 1935, plus the times the people were living in,
right,
we realized that, yes, that ended up pricing books out of reach of the typical American family.
That's
or at
right.
least
they,
to a large extent.
They were pretty luxurious. And then one day, somebody in the publishing world was home with his young daughter looking at a picture book, and the daughter was taking a bath, and the girl grabbed the book and dropped it into the water, ruining the book. And her father thought, if there was some way of printing picture books that were a lot less expensive, I wouldn't be feeling so bad about this. And in general, life would be, books would become a much more central part of family life if they were more affordable and not so precious.
Right. And
that
people
was one
might
of the
be...
ideas that gave rise to Golden Books.
Right. The idea that if you make books for children much less expensive, people will be, first of all, more able to purchase them,
mm-hmm.
and won't be so... it's sort of the difference between a Raggedy Ann doll and a beautiful porcelain doll that's up on the shelf that you would be scared to death
exactly.
to play with.
Yeah, one was a museum piece and the other was, a toy that you could really live with and play with.
So that's going to be then the story of how things so dramatically change.
Mm-hmm.
For folks who live in this neck of the woods, I think they will find quite interesting the very beginning of your book,
yeah.
where you talk about the emergence of this publishing company in
right.
Racine, the Bell City of the Lakes.
Uh-huh.
And you, I think, point out quite rightly that it was no accident that such a dynamic publisher would spring up in a city like Racine. Talk for a moment about how this was fertile ground for something like this.
Well, I was really fascinated to learn about the history of Racine. It was a magnet for inventors and enterprising young people at the turn of the last century. It was like Horatio Alger come alive. All these ambitious young people who wanted to pull themselves up and make something of themselves. And that's where the Hamilton Beach blender was invented. It's where the Case Plow Company started. It's where Johnson & Johnson is, I think, still based, but certainly started there. And there's a whole long list of unusual things that happened in Racine. And another of them was the founding of Western Printing by a couple of brothers, really, German immigrant brothers, who just really originally just wanted to get into business for themselves. And Edward Wadowitz was had some training as a bookkeeper, and he was the bookkeeper for a printing company that was about to go bankrupt, and they couldn't even pay him. So he struck a deal with them and ended up owning their company. So then suddenly he was a printer, and then he looked around for things to print, and it occurred to him that a publisher client would be a good one because publishers do new books throughout the year, so there'd always be some work for the press. So he made a deal with a publishing company in Chicago that did children's books, but they went bankrupt too. And so then he ended up owning that company, and then he saw that he was pretty good at selling books.
I thought that was, let's just touch on that for a second, because
yeah.
that's a great little story.
Yeah.
essentially they strike this deal,
All these books are to be printed. In fact, the way you describe it, it almost sounds like these books were printed for this publisher who goes bankrupt. So
that's
suddenly
right.
this printer suddenly has all these books that they were not supposed to have to sell.
Exactly
that was,
right.
So
they were stuck with the this quantity of books that they had printed for a company that could no longer survive. And so they thought they sort of turned that into an advantage and had the clever idea, the very innovative idea of selling books in places where they hadn't been sold before, namely in the new five and dime stores that were springing up all over America, Kresge's and Woolworth.
Right. At this point in time, a really important person by the name of Sam Lowe enters the picture. He really makes a big difference in striking some of these deals. Talk for a moment about where, until this point, someone would have bought a children's book and how revolutionary this new move was.
Sure. Only major cities had bookstores, and even those didn't always sell children's books, because who wants to have noisy kids with sticky fingers coming into your store? I mean, that was the mentality. Or perhaps they would just sell them for a couple of weeks leading up to the Christmas gift-giving season. So it wasn't that easy to buy a children's book in most of America. You could probably get them from Sears and Roebuck catalogs, too. But that was about it. Now, Sam Lowe was a young man who came from, he was in New York before he went out to Wisconsin, and he'd been working for the Henry Street Settlement House, doing social work with teenage boys. And he was sent out sort of as a missionary by the Henry Street people to start a similar mission in Racine. And so he began doing that kind of work and would tell stories to the teenage boys as part of his way of engaging their interest and curiosity. And then he started writing them down, and then one thing led to another. And he, when Western got into the publishing business, in addition to being a printer, he approached them and said, maybe you'd like to publish some of my books. And they did, and they also hired him as a salesman. And he turned out to be one of the real geniuses, I think, of American children's book publishing at that time, because he was the one who had the idea to sell the books to the five and dime stores. And then he had another idea, which was to, he noticed all the comic strips that were in newspapers that were so very popular, and he thought if there was some way of turning them into book form, you could sell probably thousands and thousands of copies of them. And so he created a prototype for what became the Big Little books, which were like maybe 3 by 4 inches, very thick, and they were basically compilations of well-known comic strips like Orphan Annie, with very colorful, sort of garish movie poster-like covers. And he sold those in five and dime stores, and they would sell in quantities of 600,000. So it was just staggering. And in the second year of the Big Little books, he made a deal with a new filmmaker out in Hollywood named Walt Disney and clinched an exclusive deal with him, which lasted well into the 80s, making all the books that had Disney characters in them.
You know, it's funny. You have a great quote from him, because it's no exaggeration to call this guy a genius when it comes to marketing ideas and to thinking outside the box and so on. You quote he himself as saying that a genius is simply a man who doesn't know any better.
Right.
And, I mean, to read those words, we get the picture of somebody just kind of bumbling along and by sheer luck, managing these things. And, of course, he's doing himself a grave injustice.
Sure.
I mean, he was far more than that.
Yeah. I mean, the phrase these days would be thinking outside the box. I mean, he just had one idea after another that no one had ever had before.
Hmm. In fact, if I can just jump in, you say, to quote you, one good idea led to another.
Mm-hmm.
Another good idea, which comes about this same time, comes from the fact that Western Publishing apparently had its own box department, which led to the creation of a whole other line of,
that's
of
right.
things
that
it would
their,
sell.
That's right. That was their jigsaw puzzles. They thought, well, we can make boxes, that we can ship our books in, but why not make some other product that needs a box? So they came up with jigsaw puzzles. And to me, an incredibly poignant failed or just did poorly, Western flourished. And one reason was that Americans who were, you know, feeling down on their luck and confused about their own lives would buy these puzzles. And they were inexpensive recreation. And it was kind of a way of being able to put something back together again.
So we are seeing already at this point in time the creation of a kind of book that probably left a lot of certain people in the industry sort of shaking their head in bemusement, if not downright dismissiveness.
Right.
I mean, this is a whole different way to approach the business of publishing.
That's right. I mean, the librarians who were writing, you know, criticism in the major newspapers and were giving out annual awards and doing everything they could to set a high standard for children's books hated, you know, the big little books. They were printed on cheap paper. They were not aesthetically beautiful, really. And they thought that the stories that the comics told were sensational and unrealistic, and the art wasn't that good. I think maybe they were wrong about that, but that's what they thought.
I mean,
So there was a real sort of culture clash between what Western was now doing, reaching, you know, people in hundreds of thousands with each book on the one side, and what the librarians were doing on the other side.
Right, and I suppose Western Publishing, inadvertently or not, is creating product that is going to really be easily and immediately accessible to regular people versus another kind of publishing which sort of sets the bar higher and wants to sort of raise people's standards in a sense.
Well, that's right. I mean, the libraries all around the country look to a few major librarians, mostly based in New York, for cues as to what they should be purchasing. So the librarians had a lot of power in terms of determining which books would have a life. And on the other hand, what Western was doing was going right into the hands of consumers. And the big little books sold for a dime a piece, so just about everybody could afford those. And so the librarians were cut out of the equation. Their criticism became irrelevant.
And right.
Of course, that probably made the librarians kind of annoyed.
Well, and it's interesting. I think I'm certainly speaking of their criticism with a somewhat dismissive tone, when in fact probably those librarians, at least to some extent, had a point. I mean, they weren't imagining such a seismic shift in the landscape of publishing for children and young people.
Sure.
And to some extent, at least, that did represent something lost.
No, I think you have a very good point. And I mean, the librarians were supporting very talented writers and very talented artists, and they were trying, and they succeeded in raising the standard for children's books and to some making inroads in what has been at least a century-long battle to win respectability and, you know, legitimate status for children's books as a kind of literature and a kind of art. I mean, the you know, museums are only just now beginning to display children's book art and take it seriously. It took an awful long time for that battle to be won. And the librarians had a major hand in achieving that end. But I think, and also, I mean, things have changed in our society over the last century, and reading has become, and books have become less central to our culture than they were 100 years ago. And now I think it's appreciated that children read for many reasons other than to get literature, in addition to having that experience, and that there's room for a, you know, wide range of things, including you know, things like comic books. In those days, the battle lines were drawn differently, and I think librarians were somewhat less tolerant of the notion that children should, you know, have access to all sorts of reading, and they were more interested just in giving them, you know, a taste of the best.
We're speaking with Leonard Marcus about his book, Golden Legacy. And this is a book about Western publishing itself, located in Racine, and the extraordinary changes which they helped create in the world of children's publishing in particular. So at some point, we are talking about a moment when Western publishing, probably among other publishers, begins to realize that this is a moment when perhaps we can make a dramatic expansion in the kind of children's books that are mm-hmm. produced.
Yeah. Well, Western was getting bigger and bigger. Everything they did seemed to work. It was an amazing company. And in the mid-30s, they decided that given their connection to the world of publishing, not only through the books they themselves were publishing, but all the major publishing companies that were coming to them for their printing capacity, that it would be useful for them to have a presence in New York, which was the capital and still is the capital publishing industry in America. So they set up a printing plant near New York, and then they also set up a little office in Manhattan, which they named the Artists and Writers Guild. And this was an early example of what today would be called a book packaging company. The guild had the capacity to, they would come up with an idea for a book, they would find an artist who could illustrate it, a writer who could write it, they would design it themselves, and then they would go to one of the traditional publishing houses like Harper or Simon & Schuster or Macmillan and say, here's this project you can have ready-made. And of course, the publishers were happy to do that because most of their work had already been done for them. So the Artists and Writers Guild succeeded terrifically also. They were coming up with amazing projects that were doing well. And then they thought, well, now it's... And that, by the way, was another one of Sam Lowe's ideas. And then they said, well, now that we've got this going, maybe what we want to do is form a long-term partnership with one of these established publishing companies and really dig in and do a very grand project. And that grand project turned out to be Golden Books. And the partner they chose was Simon & Schuster, which was a relatively new company and which was already known as a sort of maverick publisher, one that would be willing to take chances and do books in unusual formats that hadn't been tried before. Like, they had just published Pat the Bunny, which, you know, is still a very popular book, and it has lots of touchy-feely elements. Flaps to lift and a little bit of cloth and a little bit of sandpaper for small children to have tactile experiences. That was a really difficult book to produce because of all the extra things that had to be pasted in place. But Simon & Schuster was the kind of company that wanted to rise to the challenge. And they also were comfortable doing a book that could be criticized by the librarians as being too much like a toy. So they, like Western, were very much about breaking out of established categories. So they were good partners for each other. And the thing that Simon & Schuster had to offer was, in addition to that, was they were masters at marketing. Just a few years earlier in the late 30s, they had launched Pocket Books, which were paperback books for adults that sold for a quarter. That revolutionized the accessibility of books for adults in America. Because suddenly, instead of paying $2 for a novel at an august bookstore like Brentano's on Fifth Avenue in New York, you could walk into a drugstore and for a quarter buy a novel by James Hilton or one of the classics by Dickens. So they were really made for each other, and they spent a year or so figuring out just exactly what they wanted to do. Originally, they thought they would try for picture books that sold for 50 cents, but then they decided, let's see if we can cut that in half and bring it down to a quarter, and they figured out a way of doing it, and the timing may seem dreadful, but they launched their company in the fall of 1942, the first full year of American participation in World War II.
One of the things that had not dawned on me till I read your book was that the timing of this new line of books also coincided with the worsening situation in Europe mm-hmm. and the fact that we have an influx of gifted writers mm-hmm. and illustrators
right.
who find themselves in search of a new home. Talk for a moment about that.
Sure. Well, even one of the editorial people who became deeply involved in Golden Books, named Georges Tuplay, was a Frenchman who was living in exile in New York. And he had lots of connections in the art world in Europe. And he even paved the way for an amazing Russian illustrator named Fyodor Rozhenkovsky to get one of the last ships out of Europe before they closed the commercial sea lanes because of all the U-boats. And, you know, Rozhenkovsky was had already had a career in Russia and a career in Paris in the 20s. He was a real firecracker, wonderful artist. And so he became one of the leading members of the Golden Book stable. One of his most famous books is The Three Bears, which I think is still in print, that he did as a little Golden Book. But he also did larger books for them, like Robinson Crusoe. And then there was a Polish-Jewish emigre named Tibor Gergely, and he came over at about the same time. And, I mean, some of these stories are incredibly poignant. He had been an expressionist painter in Hungary and then in Austria and Vienna in the years leading up to the war. You know, these dark, brooding paintings. And at the same time, he had been a caricaturist for newspapers in Vienna. He, whenever a famous actor was on the stage, he would draw a picture for the newspaper. But when he came to America with his paintings under his arm, no gallery was interested in them. It was just a very different sensibility. And he literally rolled them up and put them in his closet, and they weren't found until after his death, like 30 years later. But he adapted, and he found his way to the offices of Golden Books and became their very most prolific illustrator. He'd been a socialist in Europe, a very political guy, and though he couldn't express his politics directly in America, through children's books, he often illustrated the Golden Books that had to do with working class people. There's one called The Happy Man and His Dump Truck, and there's another one called Five Little Firemen. You see these firemen racing to the rescue. And he was able, you know, in that way to express his feeling for the dignity of ordinary working people.
Hmm. As you tell his story, you remind us about something that I don't think we've touched on yet in this interview, the fact that the bright, multicolored appearance of these books and these illustrations was possible because of a special press which Western publishing had. And when we think about it, I mean, we take that kind of thing, of course, entirely for granted now. But, of course, once upon a time, it was relatively uncommon for the full range of bright colors to be seen in the pages of especially a children's book. Tell us about that, what typically books would look like, and what the presses of Western publishing actually made possible instead.
Right. Well, often illustrators had to work in black and white or with a very limited color range, because the more color you have in a book, the more times each page from each copy of each book has to pass through the press, so it adds to the cost of production. Western had a great advantage because they started as printers and they understood the technology, and they had very large presses. Larger than the average press. And so they were able, through economies of scale and through their, you know, technological edge, to bring down the cost of production. And that was one of the main ways that the Golden Books could be priced at 25 cents instead of $2. Garth Williams, who I mentioned before, wanted to illustrate the Little House books by Laura Ingalls Wilder in full color. He was already a pretty well-known illustrator at that time, and the Wilder books were almost guaranteed to sell well. But Harper, which was a more established traditional publishing company, said, no, we can't do that. It's too expensive. Another example from that same era is Robert McCloskey, who's, you know, very well-known as the illustrator of Make Way for Ducklings. He wanted to illustrate Make Way for Ducklings in color, But his editor said, no, we can't afford it. You know, so he did it in basically one color, brown, on against the white paper. So artists were often thrilled to have the chance to work on Golden Books, even though they didn't get paid as much, which is another of the ways they kept the price down. But it gave them more artistic freedom.
You talk about how as these books were about to be launched, and as the connection was being made between publisher and the stores that were the potential marketplace, that there were some concerns, some reservations about these books and whether or not they would be successful and whether or not a given store was actually all that interested in selling them. Tell us why there was at least a bit of initial hesitancy.
Sure. Well, there was, you know, a hierarchy, sort of class perception of down market and up market. The major bookstores along Fifth Avenue, the ones that sold the $2 picture books, thought it would be cheapening their store to also sell 25-cent picture books side by side with them. Plus, of course, the profit to be made on a 25-cent book was practically nil. So they had two reasons not to want to do it, but I think it was more the sort of snob factor than anything else that made some stores reluctant at first. What broke the ice was that some of the department stores around America decided, you know, for whatever reason, that they might as well give it a try.
Marshall Field's and Gimbel's and Macy's.
That's right. Yeah, and they were major sellers of children's books in those days, and so they bought in quantity, and you know, to their delight, what they saw was people coming in, and whereas what would typically have happened with an array of $2 books is, you know, the parent would stand over the selection and, you know, hem and haw and then choose one. With 25-cent books, people tended to buy all 12 of the original set and, you know, think to themselves, well, you know, I can afford this, and if three or four of them go over with my child, that's still a good deal. So they just started flying out of the stores. And once people saw that happen, once the booksellers saw that happen, of course, they wanted to get on the bandwagon.
And then it was the biggest challenge was to keep up with demand.
Right.
A nice problem to have.
Yeah, they even had to cancel some of the ads they had scheduled because they didn't want to frustrate shoppers by urging them to go to stores to buy books that were sold out.
Hmm. 12 books, I think, are part of that initial release. And you tell us that one of the real concerns was to try to convince people that although these books were inexpensive, they weren't cheap.
Right. I mean, you know, it's a sort of a classic consumer mentality. You know, the idea of you get what you pay for was a factor. People were used to expected picture books to cost more. So how do you overcome that prejudice, really, and get across the idea that there could be real value in these books? One of the ways they did it was to get a professor from Teachers College, Columbia University, Dr. Mary Reed, Ph.D., as it says, to write a little endorsement, which was printed on every Golden Book, and it was meant to be sort of like, you know, the Good Housekeeping seal of approval, an expert saying these books are, you know, are worth your while. And of course the art was kind of hard to resist. And I think in the long run, that became the major selling point for the books.
Hmm.
They were just too attractive to reach for them.
Hmm. A couple of just quick points as we finish up. There were some interesting decisions made. One of them was that, most of these books as they were published did not have, anything besides the title of the book, and then a little Golden Book at the bottom but not an author's name or an illustrator's name, that sort of thing. Tell us about that decision and what was significant about it.
Well, that was an early example of what today we call branding. an effort to make the books, each individual book, seem to belong to something larger that you, you know, felt connected to. The gold tinsel spine was a big part of that, and I can remember as a child in the 50s being absolutely fascinated by that and thinking that maybe it was real gold. You know, I wasn't sure when I was 4 years old. I thought maybe I had a treasure on my bookshelf. And so the author and illustrator's names were given on the title page but not on the cover. So everything, and of course the trim size, the, you know, the shape of the book was uniform from one copy to another. There was a list of all the titles in the line on the back inside cover, on the back outside cover. So you could check off the ones that you had and the ones that you still might want. There was a what's called a nameplate on the inside front cover, a place for the child to write his or her own name, which is a way of, you know, really laying claim to the book and making it yours. So they did. They were again very ingenious about making the book seem special and seem like nothing. Made them seem unique. They weren't like any other books. They were only like themselves.
Right. You do mention, you quote actually Lucille Ogle, who is one of the real movers in this whole publishing wing, talking about that ferocity of the librarians' resistance, which did not give up without a fight. She goes on to even say that librarians would organize programs specifically about golden books and why they should be avoided. I mean, it's really amazing. It's like something out of the McCarthy hearings of the 1950s.
Well, I mean, you know, who thought people could get that passionate about children's books? But, I mean, really, when you're talking about children's books, you're talking about your children's future. So, on some level, people do react very strongly. And I think these were all people of, you know, goodwill and the best of intentions. But they had very different ideas about what children want and need, and they were willing to go to the mat for it.
Hmm. As we look at these golden books, do we ever come across things that seem now to us offensive or racist in the same way that sometimes when you watch Warner Brothers cartoons or other cartoons from the era, we see some things that now to us might be very disturbing or offensive or unfortunate?
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, among the books that are in print now, I would say no. I mean, those have been eliminated. But in the 60s, which was the major time of the civil rights movement, critics began to take a closer look at the golden books and children's literature in general, but golden books became a special focus of interest because they were so much more widely available than any other children's books. And they did find racial stereotypes in some of the books, and in others, what was noticed was the lack of any sign of America being a multiracial society. There was a book about a typical day at the Central Park Zoo, and Whitney Young, the Urban League director who also wrote a syndicated column for newspapers, pointed to that book, saying, well, I've been to that zoo, and there were, you know, all kinds of people there, but in the pictures, in that picture book, all the children were white. And so, you know, why was that? And there was a great awakening on the part of publishers at that time who, I think, for the most part, thought of themselves as, you know, politically progressive. They were not John Birchers or Ku Klux Klan members by a long stretch. But what they realized was that they were middle-class white people publishing for other middle-class white people. And things began to change at that point.
My favorite of all the little golden books that I would have read, I had not thought of the book in decades, was The Taxi That Hurried.
Uh-huh. Oh.
I so vividly remember seeing this book and reading it for the first time when I was in first grade, which is many, many years ago, over 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you have a favorite among the classic little golden books.
Oh, I do, but before I tell you, let me just mention that your favorite was illustrated by Tibor Gergely, that Hungarian artist I mentioned. So here was another chance for him to to draw pictures of a working class person, a taxi driver.
Ah.
And it was written by Lucy Mitchell, who was the founder of the Bank Street School of College of Education. She was one of the great pioneers of American progressive education, of the nursery school movement. And she was the mentor to Margaret Weiss Brown, the author of Goodnight Moon, the person who got her started writing.
Wow.
So all this background.
Yeah, so I have better taste than I even realized.
Well, actually, yeah, and when you think about that story, it's about a mother and a child sitting in the back of a cab trying to get to the train station. They're caught in a traffic jam, and the mother starts to melt down. And where in children's books would you see a parent act in a way childishly, or certainly not in the way of a role model? It gives you an insight into the appreciation that the people who made Golden Books had for showing children life as it really is, and with a sense of humor.
Right.
Well, my favorite Golden Book is one that nobody's ever heard of, practically, and it's called Laddie and the Little Rabbit, and it was illustrated with color photographs, which was very unusual for a Golden Book.
Mm.
And it was about a brother and a sister, and I had a sister, and they had two pets, a dog and a rabbit. Laddie was the dog, a Springer Spaniel. And I was allergic to dogs, so I just loved this book because it was a way of imagining the life that I dreamed of. And I having a dog at home, and I literally did dream about that book. And I can, it shows you. We talked at the beginning about how books for kids do make a lifelong impact. I still have a sort of visceral memory of my dreams that were based on the pictures in that book. And I would go into the story and be the boy who had the dog. So it was a great way to realize my wish.
How many little Golden Books are we talking about all together?
Well, I haven't counted them up, but there were several hundred and little Golden Books. And then fairly early on, during the 1940s, the editors began to make books for slightly older kids, too, with the idea that they would, they too would want books at home. And they got into all kinds of things that would be useful for kids doing their schoolwork, books about astronomy, books about dinosaurs, books about the natural world, retellings of the Old and the New Testament, the story of the Iliad and the Odyssey, all beautifully illustrated, some in what they called the big Golden Book format, some in the giant Golden Book format. They had a lot of fun with size. And then it all sort of culminated in 1960 with the creation of the Golden Book Encyclopedia, which ran to 16 volumes, each selling for just $1 a piece at supermarkets. And they sold millions of those, and I keep running into people who, including very well-known illustrators like Walter Wick, who is the photographer who does the I Spy books now, who says that he grew up on those books and they meant the most to him.
My wife grew up in Racine. Her grandfather is pictured in the Golden Book Encyclopedia, Volume 9.
Oh, really?
He was a firefighter in Racine, and there
oh,
is
wow.
a picture of a firefighter, and it is her grandfather. And so we have that book on our shelf at home, and it's a very special place in our family's life because of that.
Oh, isn't that something? Yeah. Well, it was so touching to find out about the sort of personal side of Western, because very often two or three generations of members of a family would work for the company. It was by all accounts a very good company to work for, and they treated people well, and they got into profit sharing, very early. I think they were one of the first American companies to do that. So there was, and they became known. They were called the family of families, which I think is. How many people can say that about the place where they work? Hmm.
Leonard Marcus is responsible for this really wonderful book about the Little Golden Books and their long history. The first Little Golden Book was published 75 years ago, and so this book, first published in 2008, has been republished to commemorate this very special anniversary, retitled as Golden Legacy, The Story of Golden Books. My thanks to Leonard Marcus for being my guest on The Morning Show here on WGTD.